Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dan Cash, and it's the weekend of Paris-Roubaix, and also the Itzulia Basque Country, because two races at once is better than one.
Is it though? Is it?
And that's the voice of Cosmo Catalano. Cosmo, bike racing analyst extraordinaire, how are you?
I am well. Always a fun week to get through, I think. Particularly for you, maybe?
Yeah, one of the best.
Although you're not through anyway. You still have to record this podcast.
I'm pretty much through it. One of the best anyway, regardless of one's proximity to the action. It's quite nice to be at the races, though, to be in the Roubaix Velodrome when the action goes down. We're recording from very separate locales right now. You in Massachusetts, myself. I'm not even like one country over. I'm not two countries over. We're flying out of Amsterdam. So that's where I'm recording from. But I was in Roubaix in the Velodrome today. Got to see the action up close and personal, which often means I didn't actually get to see the race unfolding quite as well as you might have seen on TV. Fortunately, bike racing analyst extraordinaire Cosmo Catalano is here to tell you, the listeners, how this race was won. We're going to get to that in a minute. We're going to talk about how Matthew Vanderpool did the thing. He did it from farther out than even expected, which is actually the same thing I had in the run sheet last week. I didn't even have to change it because we're in deja vu mode here. We're going to talk about the Basque Country as well, just a little bit. I think we're going to mainly focus on Roubaix, but a little bit of Basque Country action because there has been some big news, but also
just drums.
There's some drums. Yeah. Is that the thing that the youth say, drums?
I have no idea. I am very right. old.
Well, we can say.
I think I'm the oldest person on this podcast. So
yeah, I think that's true, but not by a lot. There was some drama. There was some good racing in the very end when all the drama had subsided. Yeah. Anyway, before we get into that, really quickly, just a quick shout out to all of our members who make this podcast possible, make it possible for Cosmo and I to chat about bike racing and record ourselves doing it and bring that to you, the listeners. So thanks to our members. If you're not a member, we'd love to have you. Head on over to escapecollective.com/join and join the very cool club. All right, Paris-Roubaix. Let's talk about it. It finished only a few hours ago, really, and it was. I think it was kind of what was expected.
Yes and no. I would say yes, but also no. the results she was totally expected, but this was like, I think I said it with Pogacar at Strada a year or two ago, where it almost feels a little bit like Alpecin de Kooning has gotten tired of winning and is now going for Chivos on their way to victory, taking out side missions like splitting the race to like 40 people at 150K to go, 150K to go. Unprecedented doesn't even cover it. It's just not how these things happen at Paris-Roubaix. And today it did.
What's the headline?
I mean, everybody's focusing on the fact that it was the same two up front this year as last year. I'm sure there's a snappy headline in there. I don't really do snappy headlines. I do, maybe I do, but I never think of them before this podcast. So,
in that case, because here's something I know you did think of. Can you tell us how the race was won?
So we saw, you know, three sectors in, two sectors in. Paris-Roubaix, big long race, 260 kilometers-ish, 28, 27, no, 30, almost, I thought 28 or 29 sectors of cobbles. At the end of sector 27, there was a protest, a farmer's protest that had just been pushed off the road. And there were still kind of cars, maybe a kilometer, half a kilometer after the finish, the official finish of the sector. A lot of teams were out there handing out bottles. There also happened to be a ripping crosswind. And Alpecin de Kooning, they said their goal at the beginning of the day was to control the race. So they were kind of leading through the sector. They came out. They got their food, they got their bottles, they kind of looked around. Everyone else is still lined out behind them, riding not that hard, trying to get their feeds, trying to, you know, do the things you would do with 150K left in this race. And they just pinned it right down the side of the road, you know, using the wind to their full advantage. And people who were near the front kept up, maybe 40 of them, 30 of them. And the rest of the field just got cut to ribbons by Echelons. And that was the first selection of the day, 150K out. And just aggressive, full confidence racing to take that mission on.
Set the tone, to use a phrase well loved by sports writers.
I mean, it wasn't even setting the tone. Like I'm trying to think of another good sports writer metaphor to use, because it definitely set the tone, but like it set the tone by punching everyone else in the face when they were, you know, still in the warm-up, where they're shooting free throw or practice free throws, and Albus Nakuna came out and put up a full court press and nobody could score any baskets for 60 kilometers.
Yeah.
They basically cut the race down to 40 people when the race normally is barely underway. You know, the people ride three wide on the cobbles, two in the gutter, one on the crown, and they regroup after every section. And it's just like, if you're not in good position, you get beat up a little bit. This was, if you're not in good position, your race is done. It was a little weird. UAE and Groupama FDJ both kind of contributed to this. Like, they're like, oh, cool, we have three guys here. And I'm like, Albus Nakuna has six guys here. Are you sure? Are you sure you want to help out with this? And it credit to Lidl Trek for trying to make something happen. They really did push a couple of the sectors right before Arenberg. They led through the chicane, which was a non-factor completely. They led into Arenberg. After Arenberg, they had Pedersen in a group with Vanderpool, isolated-ish. But again, like, everyone else was off the back foot all day. There was the first meaningful break after, the first meaningful escape after Arenberg. Gianni Vermeersch from Alpecin was in it. They marked that. They brought him back 68K. 8K later, Vanderpool attacks. No one catches him. It was a long way out, just under 60K, but not unprecedented. I think we've definitely seen big attacks there before. The difference was today, nobody could keep up with Vanderpool and no one really tried. I feel like Stefan Kung and Pedersen gave it a shot. They did try early, but I'm saying in response to Vanderpool's attack. Like, I think if we have a Wout van Aert there, we have a Lidl Trek team with a full roster, I think we see that Vanderpool attack make a selection. I don't think we see this like right away thing that he's been doing.
He actually said that himself after the race. He said that he didn't expect to be solo after that. Like, he felt like it was a good time to attack. I think the expectation that he had was that it would course a selection, but it was already pretty selective by then, because as you point out, that the team that he rides for had done a lot of the selecting by riding really hard.
He made a selection. He made a selection of one rider there.
He did.
It was him.
A selection of one. Yeah. And from that point on,
yeah,
that's kind of it.
I mean, right? That's the thing with Roubaix, right? It's like Kung and Pedersen work to keep it pretty close, but you can't. The cobble sections and the corners and everything come so fast at the end of that race that like you can't pace line. You can have a group of 20 people against one person, and it's really challenging until kind of the last few kilometers to bring things back. And it was pretty apparent, you know, at the next sector of cobbles that Vanderpool was long gone. And at that point, you know, how hard do you want to work? You're racing for second either way, right? So
yeah, it's the sort of thing where the gap itself starts to mean a little bit less. But there was a reason to ride for some of those riders, given that there was a chase group behind them. So they weren't just, you know, cruising along. And he still did win. Ultimately, Vanderpool still did win by 3 minutes.
3 minutes exactly. Flat on the nose. Fastest ever. It was even 5.5 hours. I think it was like 5:25. Yeah. That's absurd.
Yeah, I believe it was the biggest margin since Johan Museo in 2002.
And Johan Museo had like, I think wasn't that Domo Farmfrieds? Didn't they have like four in the top seven or something ridiculous?
His squad had three in the top 10 that year.
Which was also what Alpecin de Kooning had this year. So
the 01 year, they had three in the top three.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. First and foremost, let's break down Albison teamwork again. They managed at every turn to be where they should have been. They had the positioning. They knew when to go. They put in the surges at the right time. They had riders going with the moves that went ahead of Vanderpool's move. So when there was that brief moment where there was actually a little bit of an escape off the front, they were in there. Just all around great performance by the team. That they did a really good job to take control of the race. I think there's a few facets of that bear discussion. The first is you sort of hinted at it, and I'll go a little bit further. I don't know that Alpecin de Koenig takes control of a race that has a healthy Wout van Aert, Christophe Laporte, and also a fully staffed little Trek with Pedersen and Stuyven. You know, if you have all of these riders who have crashed out or had whatever reasons they're missing the race, I think Alpecin de Koenig's quality, which is there, stands out a little bit less. And I think that needs to be said. On the other hand, they have now done this. They've been consistently performing as a team, and particularly with Vermeersch, Philipsen, and Vanderpool, that sort of big three, for not just this week. Like, it's not a fluke. And it's very clear that this team knows what they're doing, and they've developed themselves into the squad that can take control of the races just 2 years after they were a second division team, which is really, if you look, there's just lots of teams that have this ambition of coming in as a Conti squad, going up to the second division, and then we'll be world tour one day. A lot of teams have that, and not many of them succeed at it. And even fewer end up being the team that win the first three monuments of the season, which is, I mean, yeah, that's a really special achievement. That's something they should be proud of. And it's something that's just kind of rare.
I think a lot of that is Vanderpool, is having Vanderpool on the team, right? Because 150K to make the move that they made, like, yeah, it made sense. They had numbers, but there's a lot that can go wrong there, right? There's, and like, what if everybody, because they controlled that race riding on the front for like 40 kilometers. You know, what if they run out of steam with 120K to go? Like, they've burned off a bunch of guys. People are going to start catching back on. And I think there's just a real level of faith everyone has in the fact that they get Vanderpool to Arenberg, like, their chances of winning are great. You know, their chances of winning are better if they blow the field up here. So why not go for it? Because we've got that. We know what Vanderpool can do. We can take these shots. We can push people around. And I think a lot of that, I think even shorthanded, Lidl Trek rode really well. Matthias Vacek, the Czech national champion, rode really well today for Pedersen, especially after Jonathan Milan got in a crash, kind of out, basically took him out of the action. My God, what, 200K? A long way away. But yeah, it's one thing to have a strong team and control the race, and it's another to have the complete confidence to like smash the race to pieces when an opportunity comes along. And you could, the thing I loved about that was you could almost see them kind of talking about it on the road. Like, you could see Oscar Reisenbeek look back and kind of be like, yeah, guys, you know, it's pretty lined out there. And then you could see Vermeersch actually pull out, look back, and like shout something up to the front of the race. Like, yeah, let's do this. This is a good idea. I think he actually said as much in the post-race interview. Like, we were just trying to control the race. This was a great opportunity, and we all just hit it. And like, that's hard to do without a Matthew Vanderpool kind of at the back of your train, where you know, like, your effort is going
to
pay off.
It's hard to do without that. And it's also hard to do without the confidence that it is going to work. And that's not easy to acquire. And it's something we've talked about a couple times this year, where you can be really good, but the consistent performances might not come if you don't operate in a bold enough fashion to trust that your 60K out attack is going to work. And if you are a Matthew Vanderpool, you have that confidence, and your team has that confidence. It helps that they have Jasper Philipsen in the next group, the guy that won Milano Sanremo not very long ago. And yeah, all around, I think they trust themselves. And this is sort of a success breeding success situation, where All right, well, they've won the first two monuments of the year. Clearly, they know what they're doing. They're doing something right. And it makes sense then that they would trust that their superstar rider, who has now won six monuments, would deliver. Let's take a quick break. All right, so let's armchair DS this, because as much as I think Alpecin deserves credit for all the hard work they did successfully to set Vanderpool up today, he was so good that I kind of wonder how much that even was necessary. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit, Vanderpool specifically himself, that even if his team hadn't done all this, I still think he would have won quite handily, especially given the field. But I want to pose the question to you, Cosmo Catalano, bike racing analyst extraordinaire. What could the other teams have done? What could they have done differently? Was there a moment? Was there something that they screwed up? What was their opportunity here?
Things broke up so fast and so early, you know. Being where Alpecin was when Alpecin was there, and being in that position to break the race open, like, there's no, I think a couple of other teams in the race probably could have pulled that off if they'd been there and aware and ready for it. But then again, if you're not the odds on favorite with Mathieu van der Poel, why are you pulling at the front at 150K to go, right? You're going to be in your good enough position, 20 wheels back, maybe that goes to 40 when everything's strung out on the cobbles, but you'll catch back up on the next pave section. And it turned out, when the race explodes, that isn't actually a good enough position. But there's nothing to say that, a healthy Jumbo-Visma team couldn't have been there. I think Trek probably could have done it today. I think FDJ, Groupama FDJ probably could have done it. Any team that had their guys forward that was ready and really taking over the race, like, that's kind of a forgotten fundamental of cycling, right? Like, you make that energy investment to be at the front. You're in control of the race. You can play this card where you run into a weird situation with a huge crosswind and a mysteriously or an unexpectedly longer section where riders are impeded, things are narrow, people are doing stuff other than paying attention to keeping on the wheel in front of them. You can take that advantage. And I think, had any other team, had we seen what happened at Gent-Wevelgem, where we had Visma and we had Lidl Trek deciding they wanted to really take it to Vanderpool, get him isolated early, I think that sort of thing totally could have worked in this scenario. And just no one had that vision, that game plan, because of personnel issues, because what happened last week, because, maybe part of their mission was like, let's see how many guys we can get Vanderpool to burn off here, because that was a big break. That was a strong break up the road today. And there was a lot of work chasing that. It just happened to be they were chasing it in a group of 40 where they had six people, and it was kind of okay to really force that advantage and burn people off doing it.
It's Alpecin De Koenig had all this confidence in themselves, and maybe the other teams should have given them a little bit more respect, or just thought in advance that they might actually do this, because they've shown now. It's one thing if the other teams had not expected this a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. but this, we're far enough into the classic campaign now that this should have been something that at least DSs across the rest of the buses are talking about, the possibility of this. That said, though, I mean, it was early. It was early that they were at the front. It was early that they were doing everything, and they did a hell of a job to set up Vanderpool, and they did a hell of a job to put a second ride on the podium. So now that we've talked about Vanderpool a fair bit, and just to recap the enormity of all this, his sixth monument, he did it like he won Flanders in the world champion's jersey. It's really impressive. It's something that in and of itself is already, he's gotten to a level that I think is generational talent for sure. And I think he's got a lot ahead. So he just deserves credit for that. And on top of that, he was one of two teammates on the podium, because Alpecin went 1-2 in this race. And Jasper Philipsen showed that his skill set does port quite well to Paris-Roubaix. It's a race that allows him to use his ample engine and cobbles savvy. And if he has someone up the road allowing him to kind of sit on a little bit, then he's perfectly positioned to sprint in the velodrome. I think he might even be positioned to win this race on a different team in the future, but we can cross that bridge when we come to it, maybe next year.
I thought Vanderpool, he was like basically acknowledged that Philipsen would not be on his team for, if certainly not forever, and maybe even for not very much longer. So yeah, they're like, how do you feel about Philipsen's finish? He's like, yeah, you know, maybe he can win this race someday in the future, like a different team, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's showing that with every new classics result, but he's especially dangerous with Vanderpool because they complement each other. I spoke to Philip Rotoff, one of the two brothers who run this team in the Roubaix infield, and that's the word he used, that they were complementary skill sets. And I think that's true. I think Vanderpool does have a good kick. Philipsen is a classics guy, but generally speaking, you can rely on Vanderpool to be the one attacking a little bit more often and for Philipsen to be the one sprinting more often. I don't think anyone's surprised by that. That helps keep them balanced. It helps keep both of those talents, keeps the dynamic from getting too dangerously malfunctioning.
You don't have a Gilbert Van Avermaet scenario where you're like,
yeah,
why are both these guys racing the same race at the same time?
It's not quite a, you know, Cavendish and Wiggins where they're two completely different skill sets, but it's enough that they can complement each other. That's the word that Rotoff used. I think it was a good word. So they can complement each other quite well. And yeah, Philipsen today did a really fine job, I thought, of playing his role all the way to a second place finish ahead of Mats Pedersen. So the podium, in case we haven't said this 30 minutes into the pod, was Vanderpool, Philipsen, his teammate, Mats Pedersen.
Winning only. First loser and second loser are uninteresting.
Philipsen, in that sprint, though, I wanted to go to the sprint because it's sort of coming back to a topic we had before. He was really well positioned throughout the sprint. And I think Pedersen went a little bit early, but that's something that he likes to do. Mm-hmm. He didn't go super early. It wasn't super obvious when he went that it was way too early, in my opinion, at least. But Philipsen did the smart thing and kind of held back a little until the right time and was thus able to come past and take the runner-up in the end, which lends credence to the idea that you shouldn't necessarily lead out a sprint if you can avoid it.
Well, I think it's when in doubt, lead it out, right?
Yeah, if you're not in doubt.
There was not a lot of doubt here. Like, Philipsen and Pedersen are both very fast, but I think you ask 100 people, you know, who's going to win in a sprint on the velodrome at Roubaix, they're 90 probably going to say Philipsen right now.
Yeah, that's true that Philipsen would probably be the choice in a bunch kick. The velodrome in Roubaix, like after the whole day, I don't know. That's tricky. That seems like more of Pedersen's kind of thing.
He did. Yes. He beat Van Aert last year. So, I mean,
yeah.
Again, if you make me pick who is faster, I'm going to say Pedersen over Van Aert.
Yeah.
But like, Van Aert is no slouch, right? This is, I especially the way Philipsen has been riding, I'm pretty sure it was going to go that way from the moment Paulet and Philipsen got clear. So,
Third place Pedersen had some interesting things to say in the press conference. He of course looked so good like less than 2 weeks ago. Hurt himself at a crash that derailed the classics ambitions of several stars. At least in Pedersen's case, he was able to get back on the bike and get back to racing by the time Flanders and Roubaix rolled around. But the question was, how healthy was he? And of course, he also didn't have Jasper Stuyven on his team. So that meant the 1-2 punch was now just a punch. That was not, it was just a, it was a left hook, but just one punch, you know.
I thought he wrote really well. I thought he wrote
very well. And it was my very long winded way of saying in the press conference afterward, asked him how he felt his crash was still affecting him at all. If it was still affecting him at all, if his form was in his opinion, 100%. And he said, yes, he was fully healthy. No excuses from the crash at all. First of all, I like the swagger to say that. He didn't go immediately to any excuse. I appreciated that. Second of all, I mean, I don't know that I entirely believe him, because I think he would probably want to have had a slightly better buildup. Third of all, I do think third at Roubaix with a team that was, derailed was the word I used, by a previous crash, is still something to be very proud of, something to build on, something that says that Peterson can handle the repeated trips over very bumpy roads. Because I don't know, maybe this wasn't necessary, this extra data point, because he's already been on the podium twice at Flanders. But this is his best ever result at Roubaix. And I think it suggests that in the future, if Trek has just a little bit more firepower, and if maybe Vanderpool's not having this world-beating day, because that does happen, he could contend.
Like I said, I think they did about as well as they were going to do. I think, you know, they tried when they had an opportunity to do something. Maybe they could have let Vermeersch and Pollitt and Kung get a little more up the road. Maybe twisted some other arms into chasing him down, but I don't think that was going to happen. I think maybe their thought was like, let's just bring him back and see if we can get a more favorable reshuffle. And it just didn't happen. So,
and to be fair to them, I mean, trying to stick with Vanderpool and beat him in a sprint has worked for Peterson already this year. So I think it's a reasonable tactic, even if it didn't work out. A couple of unheralded riders here I wanted to mention. The guy who finished fourth, he animated the day. He confirmed the result. He confirmed that the result that he secured in this race several years ago now is something that isn't just a one-time thing. Not that anyone was questioning that. And I think he deserves credit because he did finish fourth and therefore didn't get to have the fun of being on the podium where the fire was shooting out from the ground. The cobble came up in a very fancy presentation. It's hard to explain this without I hope you watched it. It was a great celebration of the podium. Anyway, he didn't get to enjoy any of that. He finished fourth. Niels Pollitt, you deserve heralding. So I'm heralding you here. And, thank you for making this race interesting. Thanks for putting an attack before Vanderpool did, because I think that's if you're Niels Pollitt, if you're Stefan Kung, that's what you have to do. I think that was the best chance for these riders, was to try to take it to Vanderpool. It didn't work. I don't know that anything could have worked, but I think it was the chance that they had, and they rolled the dice. So they deserve some heralding. Lawrence Pithy also deserves some heralding. He's so young. He's someone who has so little experience racing at this level, and yet he has really looked like he's a veteran. He's 21 years old. And yet he came into this classics campaign, his first real classics campaign, and just has ridden like he's done it before. He's ridden like someone who is comfortable on some extremely uncomfortable roads. And he finished seventh today for a generally quite good Groupama team. Stefan Kung finished fifth, and he can sprint. The expectation for me is that he'll just get better. He'll start finding himself in the next group up, or the next group up on the road.
The next group up is winning the race. So,
well, there you go. I really mean that, though. I think that's a real possibility. And yeah,
I would say he rode like better than a veteran. He rode with just absolute fearlessness. There was no like, I can't get in this group, they're going to smash me, I'm going to get spat out the back. It was, that's a good move to be in. Those are the strongest guys. Probably one of them's going to win the race. I need to be there. And that was his entire calculus this whole spring. And it was awesome to see. And I think as someone who is not very good at riding bikes, like the things that have made me better at riding bikes are getting in groups where I probably am not going to be able to keep up and just pulling through and like getting a feel for what that power is like. That you're never going to be able to push yourself that hard in training, right? As hard as you get pushed in a race by someone who is way stronger than you. And it's just so cool to see that in a sport that can be really calculating, really, there's a lot of deception. There's a lot of pretending you're not there. You're tired, whatever. And he was just like, I'm getting in this move because it's the right move. And just amazing to see. And it was all spring long. It was from opening weekend to now, which is really incredible. And I'm really excited to see what he does kind of moving forward.
Cool to have a Kiwi doing these things. Just in terms of the style of racing, it's just not a whole lot of Kiwis doing the classics and succeeding in the last few years. Exciting for them. Overheralded, in your opinion?
The Arenberg chicane, the one thing that I heard about nonstop for the week prior to the race. Just absolute non-factor. Yes, a lot of that was, you know, we had a Cat 3 crit-sized field coming around it. All shout out to Tom Pidcock. As soon as I saw that, I was like, Pidcock is going to dive bomb this today. Pidcock came up, dive bombed it. I'm actually kind of glad that it wasn't a mess. I think the preferred option that the riders voted for, where they kind of go off to the east and kind of around and through the mining museum, is going to be really cool. I think it's going to add a lot to Arenberg. Arenberg was cool the way that like old, that English competition where they throw the wheel of cheese down a really steep hill and everyone tries to chase it. That's sort of what Arenberg was. You know, it's fun. It's exciting. It's also really stupid and people get hurt. And having a set of kind of progressively tighter actual corners, like 90 degree kind of like crit corners to progressively narrower roads leading into Arenberg is going to be really cool. You're kind of extending that position battle. There is less just like going forward as fast as you can. There's a lot more thinking about where you're putting your bike, where you're lining yourself up for the next corner. I think you'll come into Arenberg maybe with a little more speed. I can't quite tell from Google Maps how a Peloton would do it. I think today you had so little speed that it was like you're trying to re-accelerate on the cobbles. And I think that takes a little bit out of Arenberg because they're really bumpy stones. They're kind of hard to get this up to speed on. So if you can have a little bit of speed coming into that with some corners ahead of it, I think that's going to be really cool. I'm really looking forward to see how that goes next year.
All right, let's take another quick break. Your weekly Soudal Quickstep of the Classics update. Top finisher at Paris-Roubaix, Yves Lampaert, 36th. Quite a ways down. And yet another disappointment for the team that, not that long ago, dominated this kind of race. And with that note on Quickstep, let's close the book on the men's Paris-Roubaix and switch over to the women's race, Paris-Roubaix Femmes, which we'll talk. We'll have plenty of analysis on. We'll talk Matt Deneef was in the Anfield chatting with Lauren Rowney yesterday. And we'll have more this week. So plenty of coverage of the women's race there. What's the headline at least? Let's lead into the Wheel Talk podcast by just talking about the headline of the women's race.
Lotta Capecchi reminds us all why she's the world champion.
Yeah. In imperious fashion, yeah. In the velodrome.
I mean, an imperious win, but I don't like to necessarily say men's race versus women's race is better, but the women's race was better.
I think it's pretty clear this year. I was far more entertaining throughout. Yeah, that definitely.
Imperious in the good way, not in the way that makes you want to get up and like have a sandwich.
Yeah. Vanderpool was imperious as well, but this was imperious in the velodrome at the end of a great day of racing. And Wheel Talk will have all the coverage that you're looking for. So head on over to Wheel Talk for more on Paris-Roubaix Femmes. All right, let's talk Basque Country. Let's switch on over to a stage race, a quite different stage, not a cobbled, but otherwise very flat stage race, but a very, very, very hilly race in the Basque Country.
It wasn't a stage race. It was a series of unfortunate incidents.
Every day had some crashing. Every day had bad crashes to big names. And specifically, not that all of the riders' crashes are not horrible and bad and such, but it was stage four that saw the cream of the GC crop, three of the top four Tour de France contenders all crash hard, suffer injuries, and leave the race. The least injured of them appears to have been Primoz Roglic. He did leave the race, but he seems to be okay. Hopefully, he will be back in action relatively soon. The next big star and the next big Tour de France hopeful that we should talk about is Remco himself. Shoot all quick steps, GC guy, broke his collarbone in that crash. And then there was Jonas Vingegaard, who, if you haven't already heard, and I suspect that you have heard this, if you are pretty serious about bike racing and listening to the How the Race Was Won podcast, Jonas Vingegaard seriously injured in the crash, on the ground for several minutes, ultimately left the race, headed to the hospital, where he was diagnosed with several fractures, collarbone, ribs. He had lung issues as well. Okay, he's at least in terms of he was conscious. He was he's on the road to recovery, but serious impact of that crash. Very next day, Mikel Landa, Soudal Quick-Step's next rider, also out, and several others. I mean, the start list was heavily whittled down by the time they got to the end of the race, where to actually discuss the result, Juan Ayuso took the win, the overall win, which is maybe a little bit less of a surprise given how many of the big stars were out. I kept the run sheet from last week to see, and I wrote who was going to be at this race, the big names. I wrote Vingegaard, Roglic, Evenepoel, and also Juan Ayuso. And since the first three left the race, it's only fitting that the fourth guy would win. I think we've made the right call to mostly focus on Roubaix today, but like in a quick and not quite fully extensive HTRWW style, can you tell us how the race was won?
I mean,
but like just quickly,
there were crash days and there were GC days, right? The opening time trial, Roglic actually looked good. He went the wrong way and still won. I kind of half expected him to be semi-retired, but no, he looked real good. Remco also didn't have his head sock. This was the last day of legal TT helmet head sock, and he missed out. Other riders used it. Remco did not.
It's a story, yeah, for sure.
Very sad. We had these sprint days. Stage two at least was wet, so you had a lot of crashes kind of taking people out, but Paul LaPierre from Decathlon took it. Stage three had a really cool uphill sprint won by Quentin Hermans, but also bone dry, and Roglic actually crashed early, and then Carlos Rodriguez and Juan Ayuso, who were 1-2 at the end of the race, also crashed. So no one got out of this really completely unscathed. Four, as we mentioned, was the crazy crash day. Matias Skelmosa actually ended up inheriting the lead. And then stage five, we had the Landa crash, another sprint, Roman Grégoire from Groupama FDJ. And then stage six was kind of a hilly rolling day, definitely designed as the queen stage. 16K to go. They get clear, one of those situations where it's very clear, I think, how the spoils will be awarded. Rodriguez took the stage. Ayuso came in second. Skelmosa was pulling his group, came in fourth, I believe, after Marc Soler, but managed to hold on a third overall. Or should I say lost second overall. Ayuso was pretty well clear. And I think just a couple seconds between Rodriguez and Skelmosa at the end.
I like the way, I think it was Cycling News described the working together of Rodriguez and Ayuso at the end. It was an, quote, unspoken alliance. Mm. And it worked out quite well because Rodriguez got himself the stage win, got himself second overall. And believe for Rodriguez, that's his highest GC showing in a World Tour race so far in his young career. Great job from him. And for Juan Ayuso, first World Tour GC win. Yes, obviously, it's a race that was suddenly down its big pre-race contenders, but a win's a win, and Juan Ayuso took it.
Is it, people crash out of every bike race, right? Is it that big a deal it is a big deal, obviously, when the headline names crash out. But like, it is, the reaction to this has been kind of like, this was an excuse for everyone to complain about things they were already complaining about. Like, oh, why are there so many crashes now? And what you mean to say is we've had, you know, four super top names crash out in a week and a half. And yeah, that's statistically improbable, but I don't think it reflects anything, anything data driven. You can say, oh, there are more crashes. Like, I don't necessarily know that there are. Nobody takes...
Which there could be.
There could be.
You're saying we want more data.
Well, no one... it would be entirely possible at the end of every race to like go through the DNFs and communicate with them and be like, what happened? Did you crash? How did you crash? Were you injured? What do you think caused the crash? Get this data. And then you can say in a given time period, there were more crashes after, you know, January of this year to the January of the previous year. Like, what changed in that period? Were speeds higher? Was anything different? Were people using narrower handlebars? But there isn't that. It's always like, oh, a bunch of crashes just happened. It must be this other thing that's been happening that I don't personally like. And that's just no way to deal with the issue. Like, there's a lot of information here that could be gathered that could be really valuable to keeping people from crashing or helping people crash less or crash in less severe ways. And no one is taking that on. They're just using it as a cudgel to complain about whatever other thing they were complaining about. And it's dumb. And we should deal with crashing better than we currently deal with it.
It's a very nuanced and conscientious approach to it. So I'm sure everyone else will adopt it. yeah, that's, I mean, for this race, the crashes were really the big story, but credit to Ayuso. He may have benefited from the Escape Collective bump. He did talk to me just before the race. So please come chat with me if you want to go win a big bike race. And there is a big bike race coming up. Last topic for this week, Amstel Gold Race, the Netherlands. There happens to be a Dutchman racing who will be very popular here. I'm in the Netherlands right now. Just realizing this as I say it, here on home roads. He's just won a big race. Will anyone challenge Matthew Vanderpool? I guess we'll find out.
Tom Pidcock could. This is a race that's pretty favorable for him. I think maybe even especially against Vanderpool, but we will see.
I agree with that. I think that's a really good point, actually, because I think Vanderpool's skill set is a little more suited to things that are flatter, just to put it simply. Yeah, that's coming up. That'll be happening a week from when you and I are recording. In the meantime, you'll have a chance to listen to Wheel Talk, which will break down the women's race, women's Paris-Roubaix. You'll have a chance to hear the placeholders. We'll have some geek warning action. It's going to be a busy week of podcasting, busy week of racing. Amstel coming up. Flesh and Liège-Bastogne-Liège after that. Giro, not that far away.
Wow.
Honestly.
Grand Tour.
Kind of great. Romandy first, though, which is one of my favorites for the good photos. Anyway, lots coming up. So, we bid adieu to the Cobbled Classics, but we say bonjour to the Ardennes. Or we say that in Dutch, probably, because the first one, you know, it's Amstel.
Hello.
Yeah, right. That's it for us. Hope you enjoyed. Hope you enjoyed Paris-Roubaix. I'm Dane Cash, and who are you? What was this?
I'm Cosmo Catalano, and that was the How the Race Was Won podcast.